Hello and welcome to the China Business Brief, a podcast by the China Britain Business Council where we explain the latest news relevant to anyone working in or with the world's second largest economy. I'm Joe Cash, and the question for today is, do Chinese consumers still want to buy British? It's a slightly worrying thought, but one that's been on the minds of those working for British luxury goods brands this year nonetheless. With a spate of consumer boycotts in March, and the announcement of the government's goal of common prosperity over the summer, and if you want to hear more on that, do check out our previous episode where we unpack what that might mean, it's been a slightly confusing year. So today, I'm delighted to be joined by Adam Knight of Tong, one of CBBC's member companies, for what we hope will be a whistle-stop tour of the sector and some do's and don'ts on consumer culture in China. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we dive into all of that, and it's a busy episode, perhaps you could briefly introduce your company, Tong, and what led you to get involved in China's consumer sector.
Absolutely. So I'll give you the strapline. Tong is a cross-cultural agency closing the gap between people and brands in and out of China. Bit of a mouthful, but broadly speaking, we exist to help brands navigate some of the unique challenges, opportunities that can be found in Chinese consumer culture, helping brands to adapt to a changing world in which China's emerging consumer communities and subcultures are going to be reshaping the face of retail. Over the last 7 years or so, we've launched well over 100 brands into the market. In terms of me personally, I'm one of the co-founders here at the business. We started this back in 2014, a long time ago now. This was a coursemate of mine, James. We were both studying Chinese at university and had just come back from our year abroad in Beijing. And this was kind of peak golden era, the height of marketing sophistication when it came to UK brands back then was slapping a Union Jack on the side of your packaging and talking about Downton Abbey or Harry Potter. I.e. the barrier to entry was pretty low. Things have evolved dramatically since then, as has our agency. So we're a team of about 35 or so, give or take, across London and Shanghai. And I'm constantly blown away by the creativity and consumer empathy that that this team displays across the dozens of campaigns that we're running every year.
Thanks, Adam. That's a great introduction and really sets the scene for today's conversation. And I suppose my first question is, looking back over those previous 7 years to the present day, how would you characterize the current health of China's consumer sector? How have things changed for you and your company?
I think for now, in a word, China's consumer sector is buoyant, certainly at the kind of premium and luxury end of the spectrum. I think if we roll back a year and a half or so, China was, of course, first into the pandemic slump. But it was also the very first major economy to accelerate out of it. But that recovery has been very much kind of two-track. So wealthier citizens have so far emerged largely unscathed financially, while those that are at the kind of lower income end of the spectrum have continued to struggle. Of course, this has been amplified by a lot of the recent developments when it comes to the energy sector. And the reason for this kind of two-track development has been quite simple. I think in Europe, the government response to COVID, from an economic standpoint anyway, was to kind of keep money in people's hands. And you saw this through schemes like furlough, through kind of business recovery loans, grants, etc. Whereas in China, the focus was very much on credit easing, as well as on the kind of construction and financial sectors. And this approach essentially sent equity and housing markets soaring, meaning that obviously those that had stakes in those sectors, i.e. the kind of consumers at the higher end of the economy, also saw their wealth soar in that time. And this was, of course, in contrast to kind of middle income or lower income residents who really did kind of suffer in the way that you would probably expect during such a downturn. However, if we're looking at that kind of premium luxury end of the spectrum, what this, of course, meant was that luxury retail in particular has really been booming like nothing else in China. If we look at some of the data from the major luxury fashion houses, so your LVMH, Kering Group, etc., while they reported kind of double-digit slumps at the global level, they were simultaneously seeing double-digit growth in China. Kering Group, for example, they were down something like 68%, in the rest of the world, excluding China, but up 40% in China. And that those kind of numbers were pretty representative across the sector. Now, the reasons for this, or kind of how sustainable this is, kind of really the question is, you know, if we look back to last summer, there were a lot of media reports about revenge spending. So people coming out of lockdown with money burning a hole in their pocket. And indeed, you know, some of this kind of luxury rebound was definitely down to that. But these sales have been sustained. And actually, one of the biggest factors, or the biggest kind of shifts in luxury retail anyway in China, has been the changing geography of consumer spending. So whereas previously, quite a significant amount of luxury spending was done abroad by Chinese travelers, students, etc., we're now seeing a lot of that spending repatriated. And obviously, brands that have a strong physical footprint in China, as well as a strong e-commerce presence, are the ones that are doing best in the market. And I think for British brands looking ahead, this is kind of where the current emphasis has got to be, given that travel is not really going to resume in any real, certainly not going to bounce back to the levels it's been at previously for at least another 12 months, if not possibly more like 2 years.
Thanks, Adam, for setting the scene. And I'm sure many of our listeners in the sector will be happy to hear that, into your mind, it remains buoyant. Now I want to turn our attention to some of the more troubling undercurrents that we mentioned in the beginning of our session, that of Guoqiao, which can be simply translated as the rise of the national brands and refers to a situation in which political or socioeconomic undercurrents promote the rise of domestic brands and also the return of common prosperity to the government's vocabulary. As you mentioned, these two have come about in part due to issues such as a broader disparity between who has wealth and who is seeking to accumulate wealth, those who have invested in housing, for example. And do you think British luxury good brands should be concerned that the government is trying to take China in such a direction? Do you think that means that the market is going to be turning away from brands that might, under the new terminology, be seen as ostentatious or flashy or not agreeing with the direction of the party? Or do you think people are putting too much into the idea that common prosperity is here to stay and that means that Burberry is going to have to stay away?
Yeah, I do think the market is strong. And I do think whether it's Guoqiao, common prosperity, etc., none of these issues pose an existential threat to the market as a whole. But of course, they do need to be factored into individual brand strategies. And those brands that don't take those into consideration and don't adapt will, of course, be left behind. Let's take each of those in turn. So let's start with common prosperity. So as you said, this is obviously something that's fairly new in China. It's been mid-August, I think it was when Xi Jinping gave his speech or talking about common prosperity, trying to regulate excessively high incomes, etc. And if we look at the luxury space, I think this could potentially take multiple forms. It could be something like higher taxation on luxury goods. It could be further customs control on Daigou, so these kind of personal shoppers outside of China. It's already started to take shape in a bit of a crackdown on big platforms like Alibaba. It could be regulation on online advertising, and of course, a crackdown on China's influencer space, which has always been a bit of a wild west anyway. Now, when Xi gave this speech back in August, luxury stock prices plummeted. So there's a kind of an average downturn of about, I think it's kind of 12-13%. So LVMH lost about 30 billion euros in market cap. Kering lost 10 billion, I think. So, you know, big numbers. But I think the thing to kind of bear in mind here is that we have seen this before. If we rewind a decade when Xi first came to power, there was, of course, a big crackdown on luxury spending then as part of his kind of anti-corruption campaign. And kind of high-value, hard luxury gift culture was somewhat kind of tempered. So the luxury watch category saw a huge, huge downturn. It was hit very hard by these regulations. But that's a category that has now recovered, but in a different form. It kind of looks a little bit different now. Those brands have adapted. Now, I think that potentially a tax hike on luxury goods could be the most impactful thing that, you know, for luxury brands to consider here. But I do also think it's like relatively unlikely. China has worked quite hard over the last few years to repatriate as much of luxury spending as it can. Again, if we go back kind of 10 years or so, almost all of luxury spending was being done overseas. And this, of course, gave rise to things like cross-border e-commerce, where the Chinese government was trying to get spending done within China's borders so that they could get some tax receipts from that. And I think that if China were to just simply increase VAT on luxury goods, that all that would do is essentially push a lot of that luxury and high-end retail spending overseas again, of course, once travel can resume. And I think that the Chinese government's unlikely to want to do that. Now, of course, there is going to be an impact for this. And I think that the impact is mostly going to be on consumer taste. Again, there have been consumer trends over the last few years for a more kind of pared back, decelerated style of consumption. And I think that, you know, that's less blingy, less ostentatious. And I think that's going to be the main impact of the kind of common prosperity shift that we see here. I should also say that this podcast recording comes at quite a good time. I was just looking at LVMH stock prices this morning. And actually, as of today, they've actually returned to the same level they were at before Common Prosperity was announced in August. So although there was a big downturn at the end of August, those brands have recovered since then. Thinking about Guochao, this is a slightly separate issue, and I think one that's quite exciting, really. As you kind of said, I would characterize Guochao as essentially a kind of consumer re-evaluation of the label made in China and what it means to consumers and their kind of self-identity. And again, I think we should understand this as a shift in cultural confidence in China, as traditional kind of Chinese motifs, designs, etc., are becoming more popular and more widely sought after. Now, in the West, we often dismiss this as a kind of symbolic form of blind patriotism, but I do think the reality is a little bit more nuanced. I think it's a blend of consumers just demanding more from their brands. Secondly, it's also a kind of nostalgia and pride that has previously been kind of suppressed or overlooked. And I think overall, Guochao represents a desire to reconnect with China's history and culture through fashion and design. It's an interesting kind of trend because it's kind of coming from both ends of the spectrum. We've got, on the one hand, the Chinese government at that kind of top level that is encouraging things like Guochao through its kind of Made in China 2025 policy. But it's also being driven by a degree of kind of organic engagement, driven by Gen Z consumers in particular, who are becoming more and more interested and excited by domestic brands and motifs. And then you've got, of course, you know, the big platforms like Tmall, et cetera, who have been supercharging this trend by launching kind of dedicated spaces, incubators, funds, etc., to develop this kind of homegrown talent. Now, of course, what this is leading to, and I think this is obviously, you know, of major concern to some brands in particular, some foreign brands, is it's leading to the rise of some really, really mega domestic brands that are starting to lead in their respective categories. I think there's one of the best examples is in the beauty space, Florasis or Huasizi. Founded only in 2017, it's a brand that is based almost exclusively on ancient Chinese recipes, motifs in their packaging, very kind of traditional focused in a lot of ways. As I said, launched only in 2017, but by 2019, it was already amongst the kind of top 10 brands on Tmall, generating over 1 billion renminbi in sales. By 2020, that had tripled to 3 billion, and it now outperforms pretty much all of the major international beauty brands in terms of sales and consumer engagement. Another interesting brand to bring up is Anta. This is a Chinese sportswear brand who this year is on track to overtake Adidas in terms of its market cap, which is absolutely just mind-blowing. Now, this has been driven by a huge swell in interest amongst consumers that are looking for a domestic champion. Part of their success is because they were sponsors of the Olympics this year. All of the Chinese team were wearing their gear, and that obviously kind of had an impact. But it's also a kind of representation of a bit of blowback against brands like Nike and Adidas, who obviously suffered in some of the consumer boycotts at the beginning of this year related to the Xinjiang cotton controversy. And Anta and a range of other Chinese domestic brands really started to kind of plant their flag in the ground as saying, you know, we are the domestic player here. We are not bowing to these kind of Western pressures for a kind of particular kind of version of corporate social responsibility. And we can kind of fly the good flag here. Now, Guochao is a very exciting trend, and I think that it is somewhat problematic in some of these kind of slightly more nationalistic ways, but I do think that it also offers some really exciting opportunities if you're a brand that embraces it and looks to kind of develop in a slightly more culturally nuanced way.
I mean, I think one of the most interesting elements to Guochao is the ways in which certain companies in certain sectors are having to identify as more Chinese, despite not being Chinese, and certain brands in other areas are having to identify as more foreign. And it also can bite the other way, that certain Chinese brands are trying to not be seen as cliche or too Chinese. And using key opinion leaders and an e-commerce platform has become more and more important. To you, what are some of the strategies that successful brands in China have used to distinguish themselves as either being more Chinese, less Chinese, or just proud of their own brand?
I mean, for us as an agency, all of the work that we do in terms of speaking with brands and helping them to think through these questions boils down to essentially consumer empathy. So understanding who that target consumer is, what it is that's going to resonate with them, and essentially building backwards. And I think that if we look at the very long, very broad history of brand failures in China, whether it be, you know, brands that were just too early to the market or were on the wrong platforms or have been culturally insensitive, a big part of a kind of common theme, I should say, across all of those case studies has been essentially a kind of, for want of a better word, a bit of a segregation in terms of strategies. So often you'll have brand decision makers at the global level, who will, of course, kind of set global DNA up. And then you have local teams who are essentially outsourced to kind of handle China. And those will either be people on the ground or they'll be local agencies. And it's this kind of slightly orientalized, you know, never the twain shall meet. You kind of, China's often kind of treated as this far-flung entity that, you know, obviously delivers a certain line item on your international balance sheet, but isn't necessarily to be engaged with at that global level. And a big part of what we do as an agency now is to try and bridge that gap slightly and raise what we kind of call the China literacy amongst global decision makers. I think given that China is, you know, well on its way to making up at least 50% of global luxury spending. Those are projections by 2025 by Bain. Given its importance to global retail generally, I think it's, you know, gone are the days where you can kind of call yourself a brand marketer or global leader or what have you without having a genuine and quite deep understanding of how China operates. And I think just outsourcing things to local teams is a little old hat. What we do is help brands to, like I said, understand what's going on in China, to increase their own consumer empathy. So kind of understanding who that target consumer is, who are the subcultures and communities that are driving retail trends in China, and then to build in to your global DNA at that kind of top level, to make sure that there's somewhat of a dialogue rather than it being a one-way street, which is how a lot of brands tend to treat China. But I think that if we think of the Chinese consumer as a global consumer that is starting to shape retail at that global level, then that kind of conversation is going to be absolutely necessary.
Thanks, Adam. And I think that's a great place to end. We've covered so much ground in the last 20 minutes or so. The political implications of Guochao, common prosperity, how brands are branding themselves, rebranding themselves, navigating the policy environment that may or may not impact them. The fact that companies need to start thinking about Chinese consumers not only as within the mainland, but as having an impact on consumer goods worldwide and how they're going to affect tastes for decades to come. I suppose the only remaining question is, how can listeners get in contact with you and your colleagues at Tong if they have any further questions?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Well, first of all, I would recommend, I couldn't come on this podcast without plugging our own podcast. I would recommend checking out our own podcast, which you can find on Spotify if you type in Tong. But otherwise, you can reach us on tongdigital.com, or of course, you can reach me at adam.knight@tongdigital.com.
Brilliant. Adam, thanks for coming on the podcast. This has been great.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Joe.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back in another 2 weeks' time with another episode of the China Business Brief. Goodbye. The China Business Brief is a podcast brought to you by the China Britain Business Council. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you're subscribed. To find out more about our other events and activities, do check out our website at www.cbbc.org.